This is Talking Dementia with Remo Health. I'm your host, Dr. Emily Silverman. Join us as we explore the latest advancements, insights, and strategies that help empower those living with dementia and the families that support them. Each episode, we speak with leading experts, from physicians and researchers to policymakers and clinicians, to provide you with the resources needed to navigate this complex disease. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Armin Mughamian. Armin is a neurologist and medical director of the Ray Dolby Brain Health Center at the California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco. He leads a multidisciplinary team of doctors, nurse practitioners, neuropsychologists, and social workers in the treatment of patients with cognitive impairment. He also heads the clinical trials program at Dolby with a specific focus on Alzheimer's. Armin went to undergrad at UC Berkeley, got an MD-PhD at Penn, and did neurology residency and fellowship at UCSF. Armin, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Armin, you're an expert in Alzheimer's disease. Let's start simple today. What is Alzheimer's disease?
Alzheimer's disease is the most common but not only cause of dementia in the United States. It accounts for about 60 to 80% of dementias. Whenever somebody comes into the clinic, we define them based on how much the cognitive impairment impacts their function. So at the earliest stages, it's called a mild cognitive impairment. That means that they have symptoms of cognitive change that they're adapting around, so there's no functional impact. They may be more reliant on a calendar, but they're still doing it all themselves. Then you get into a dementia stage where now you're having increasing functional declines. So in the earliest stages of a mild dementia, they need some help with management of medications and finances. Maybe they stop driving. In the moderate stage, the patient needs prompting around some activities of daily living, a reminder to take a bath, a reminder to change their clothing. And in the severe stages, they need help with everything. So they're fully dependent on a caregiver or a family member to care for them, to do all of those activities of daily living. Now, that stage could be due to a lot of different causes. You could have dementia due to Alzheimer's disease, which is, as I said, was the most common, but you could also have dementia due to a stroke or frontotemporal dementia, other kinds of brain diseases. Alzheimer's disease is the accumulation of abnormal proteins in the brain. There's two proteins that accumulate that clump up. The first one that accumulates is called amyloid, and the second one that clumps up is called tau. And as these proteins accumulate in the brain, they cause cells of the brain, the neurons of the brain, to not work as well. And ultimately, they start to degenerate, they die, and that results in the clinical symptoms. So it's a very long answer to say that Alzheimer's disease is a pathology that accumulates in the brain that causes a slowly progressive decline in cognition over a number of years.
So it sounds like one of the things that makes Alzheimer's disease unique is its cause. So unlike a stroke where you have some damage to the brain from a lack of blood flow, and unlike other diseases and other causes of dementia, the cause here is very specific. It's an accumulation of abnormal proteins in the brain, and there are two specific proteins, amyloid and tau. Does everyone with Alzheimer's disease have these abnormal proteins in their brain? And on the flip side, does everyone with these abnormal proteins in their brain have Alzheimer's?
Excellent question. What we also have to realize is that the disease has changed in some ways as we have learned more about it. 30 years ago, the clinical syndrome of Alzheimer's disease, which is what people typically associate as memory loss that progresses over time, was as good as we could do to understand whether they had that pathology that we talk about of amyloid and tau. But what we've developed now are tools to be able to find that pathology in the living patient. And so at this time, the field feels that to have Alzheimer's disease, you have to demonstrate that you at least have amyloid in the brain. We also have tools to be able to show tau in the brain. Now, not everybody needs to get that test, but if you wanted to have a confirmatory diagnosis, you can. Alzheimer's disease, it's a little technical term, but used to be a diagnosis of exclusion, meaning that used to say, well, it's not all these other things, so it's probably Alzheimer's disease. But now it's a diagnosis of inclusion, which means that actually we can do a test that proves that this is Alzheimer's disease. So short answer is yes. In order to have Alzheimer's disease, you need to have amyloid and tau in your brain. The flip side to what you just said, which is that does everybody that have amyloid and tau in the brain have Alzheimer's disease? That's a little more controversial. I would say that yes, they do, and they're on a continuum. So you can have amyloid in your brain and not have symptoms of it. You are on the continuum of Alzheimer's pathology. Some factors that we can't measure, but the primary one is time, that over time, your risk of developing cognitive impairment due to that pathology just goes up. It's really important to understand the time scale, though. Alzheimer's disease is an incredibly slow process. Amyloid accumulates in the brain 20 years before symptoms really arise and slowly accumulates, which leads to this tau accumulation, which leads to the clinical symptoms of neurodegeneration. So that could be scary for some people, but it's true that Alzheimer's disease is this pathology that accumulates over time. So if you do have that pathology, you're on this pathway towards developing Alzheimer's disease and your risk is increasing for developing the clinical manifestations, the syndrome of memory loss, which people fear. The last thing I'll say is that this is very similar to other diagnoses. So not everybody with a small breast cancer is going to develop metastatic cancer and is going to be dying from breast cancer. So we need to be better at understanding who's going to progress onward and who might not. And that's an area of active investigation in understanding this disease.
So what I'm hearing is that this process of abnormal protein accumulation in the brain is really slow. And you could be having these proteins in your brain for 5, 10, 20 years before you even show a symptom, which to me, that sounds somewhat reassuring. But does that mean that Alzheimer's affects elderly people? Is this a disease then that we would expect to see in people in their 80s and 90s and hundreds? What about the people who get a diagnosis of Alzheimer's when they're in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, these early onset cases? How are those cases different from the cases in older people? And what causes the rate of accumulation in the brain?
It is certainly a disease that increases in risk as people get older. By the time people get into their mid-80s, you could say 30 to 50% of people will have some level of this abnormal accumulation of protein in their brain. And that risk just goes up with age. But it doesn't mean that it's exclusively a disease of older people. So the majority of patients are in their older years, but you certainly can get early onset Alzheimer's disease. So patients that have onset of symptoms before the age of 65 are defined as early onset. 65 was picked primarily because patients that have this early onset have a higher risk of a genetic cause of Alzheimer's disease. There are three fairly rare genes that if you have that gene, you will get Alzheimer's disease. And that typically happens in people that are below the age of 65. Although any patient that's below the age of 65 that has Alzheimer's disease has probably less than a 1 out of 10 chance of having one of those genes. They're pretty rare. But after the age of 65, we rarely think about it. As far as the manifestations of the disease in the early onset patients versus the patients after the age of 65, they're typically similar. There's some atypical forms of Alzheimer's disease. So let's start by defining the typical presentation of Alzheimer's disease. This is what people associate with that word. Slowly progressive decline in primarily short-term memory. So this is difficulties with retaining new information, difficulties with remembering appointments and reminders. You're having a conversation with a loved one and 5 minutes later you ask the same question in the same exact way. That's a short-term memory loss. You may misplace items in the house. That's what we call the amnestic, the lack of memory version of Alzheimer's disease. And that is the most common form in the late onset as well as the early onset. But in the early onset patients, they also have a risk of developing atypical forms of Alzheimer's disease, which is that the abnormal proteins are accumulating in different areas of the brain and can cause a different type of clinical manifestations of the disease. And the atypical versions of Alzheimer's disease have some funny names, but one is called posterior cortical atrophy. And these are people that have more difficulties with spatial relationships. There's a language version of Alzheimer's disease called the logopenic. These are people that have a lot more difficulties coming up with words. There's a version of Alzheimer's disease called the frontal variant of Alzheimer's disease that they have more behavioral symptoms or more difficulties with attention and multitasking rather than memory. And the last one is a version of Alzheimer's disease called cortical basal syndrome, which is more of a motor syndrome that almost looks a little bit like Parkinson's disease, typically affecting one side over the other. So those atypical forms of Alzheimer's disease are more common in the early onset patients, but still that memory specific version is the most common across all comers, early or late.
So in the old days, the only way we could really confirm the diagnosis was after a patient passed away, would do an autopsy, would look at the brain on autopsy and find these abnormal proteins in the brain. Like you said, these days we're able to actually detect those proteins while the patient is still living. Is that through an MRI? Is that through a PET scan? What kind of imaging is that? And then are you also able to find biomarkers in the blood that mark these proteins as well? Talk about the new tests that we've developed over the last few years to decades.
I think I need to take one step back even more is what is a typical patient going to walk into my office and receive as far as the tests they do? There's always a functional test of the brain, and then there's a structural test, and then there's a pathology test. I make the analogy towards construction. The MRI of the brain is the blueprint. It tells you where the walls are. It tells you if there's a hole in the wall or part of the wall that's missing. But it doesn't tell you anything about the function of the brain. It just tells you about the structure. And it doesn't tell you if there's any mold in the walls. The cognitive testing that people go through, I liken that to the utilities. Is the plumbing working? Is the internet on? Is the electrical on? What of those utilities are working and what aren't? And that may tell you in certain rooms that it's on and certain rooms aren't. And then the biomarkers, this thing called a PET scan, tells you if there's any mold in the walls, basically. So there are different tests that ask very different questions. So specifically, we use this word called biomarkers, which are biological markers of the disease, telling you, do you have that abnormal protein in the brain? Do you have that pathology? A PET scan is a way to measure the amyloid in the brain. So an amyloid PET scan, it's two pieces. Amyloid is what we're measuring, and a PET scan is the type of imaging scan. So it's a way of quantifying the level of amyloid in the brain using a picture. And what patients get is they get injected with a tracer, a drug that binds to amyloid. And if you have amyloid in the brain, it releases a specific type of signal. And if you don't have amyloid, then you don't get that signal. You could also get PET scans for cancer. You could also get PET scans for tau, although those are more in the research realm these days. You can also measure the levels of amyloid and tau in the brain by assessing the spinal fluid. This is a little bit more invasive. It's called a lumbar puncture. Very similar to the procedure women get with an epidural, but instead of putting medicine in to numb people up, you take some fluid out and you send it to the lab to measure the levels of amyloid and tau in the brain. And there's a specific pattern of findings that are consistent with the pathology of Alzheimer's disease. The spinal fluid analysis and the PET scan are roughly equivalent at finding the pathology of Alzheimer's disease in the brain. Patients tend to like doing the PET scan because they have to sit on a table instead of getting a needle into their back, which I understand as well, although the lumbar puncture itself is not as bad as it sounds. Now, you ask a really great question about, can we measure the levels of these proteins in the blood? And this has been a major area of research and major areas of breakthrough, really in the past 5 years or so. We have really good markers that can find that pathology in the blood. They're not quite ready for prime time. I suspect in the next 1 to 2 years, they're going to be more widely available. They're just starting to peek their head out, but insurance isn't covering them. And there's some issues in getting it out en masse and reliably en masse. But I think those challenges will be overcome. And I suspect in the next, as I said, 1 to 2 years, you're going to be able to get a blood test that at least gives you a probability of whether you have that pathology in the brain, and maybe even diagnostic. I think in the short term, we'd probably still do those confirmatory tests, but we may in the future be able to just do a blood test to see if you have that amyloid in your brain.
You talk about how Alzheimer's dementia progresses in stages. So some people may have no symptoms at all, and they may have these abnormal proteins in their brain and not even know it, and it's just really early stages. Then you talked about mild cognitive impairment and early and middle and late stage of dementia, and how often it progresses really slowly. So that if you receive a diagnosis, it doesn't mean that next week you're going to be in bed and unable to take care of yourself with severe dementia. This is something that takes time. But you've talked in the past about the stigma associated with Alzheimer's disease, and how when people hear Alzheimer's, they go straight to that severe, severe stage. It's what they think of immediately. And this narrative of, no, actually, this is a progressive disease that takes time, and there are things you can put in place to prepare, that narrative hasn't quite yet penetrated the public consciousness. So I was wondering if you could talk about the stigma associated with Alzheimer's, and then maybe walk us through some things that you tell patients and families to try to quell their fears and anxieties upon receiving an Alzheimer's diagnosis.
It's challenging. It's a challenging disease because of that preconceived notion of what patients think of with Alzheimer's disease. So it's never a comfortable conversation for the patient. It's never really a comfortable conversation for me either, even though I do it frequently. I do think it's empowering to understand what's going on. So I'm always an advocate for diagnosis. And I think the earlier that you get diagnosed, the more likely you are to be able to adapt around the disease to have a good quality of life. Every patient and family, no matter what I say, still feels kind of bad after they hear the diagnosis. And there's nothing I can do about that. But what I do is I set the stage and tell them this is a years-long process. And they're going to leave and they're going to be really sad. But actually, the best way to heal through that is the time. So typically, I describe what I've already told you about the stages of the disease. This is where you're at. This is the typical timeline. One thing that we struggle with is I don't have an ability to predict accurately how people will transition to this. I give them very general timelines, years, 5 years, 10 years, these very generic terms. But what happens is they leave the office, 3 months pass, and then they realize, wait a minute, I haven't changed that much. And 6 months pass, and they realize I haven't changed that much. And so it's that time and being able to walk with somebody through this and know that they can reach out to me and our team, that they realize actually this is going to be okay. And I always also put it into perspective that you probably had this disease for a number of years already, and you were the same person that you walked in as you are now. Now you just know why. As far as the stigma, it's definitely there. There are a lot of patients that don't want to talk about it in public. And the only way stigma goes away is if people start feeling more comfortable talking about it. There's education from doctors and patients. We just start talking about it. The more we hide it, the more stigma there's going to be because people feel this need to hide it. But there's nothing to hide. But it's going to require some people kind of being at the forefront and owning their diagnosis. You know, everyone asks me, oh, should I share this with people? And my general recommendation is that, yeah, you should share it, but you need to share it when you're ready to share it. This isn't a diagnosis that is, oh, I sprained my ankle yesterday when I was walking up the stairs. You give this diagnosis to a friend, they're going to ask you questions. So if you're not ready to answer those questions, then don't bring it up. And start local, start with your closest family and friends. I mean, hopefully someone is already there with you hearing this, because I think that's very important to always bring somebody with you. So your spouse or your children is your first sort of people that you share it with, your closest friends, and then spread it out as you feel comfortable. And I think the other aspect is that it's important for people to know that you're receiving care. They may notice something. They may be worried about you. So in some ways, you're relieving some of the anxieties about people that really care about you. So I don't have the magic solution to this stigma. I do think that stigma will go away as people get a better understanding of what this disease really is. And that has gone through many other diseases, including cancer, including infectious disease. People didn't really want to talk about it. But the more people understand, the more they realize it's not their fault, the more they realize that it's not going to spread to them, the more comfortable they will in talking about it. And then the last piece is that the more people talk about it, the more likely people are going to come in at an earlier and earlier time, which I think is generally better for everybody. It's going to take time, though.
Let's say I'm a 63-year-old woman and I have a very vibrant career in business, let's say. And I start to notice things, or maybe my friends and family start to notice things. We come into your center, we get an evaluation, we get an MRI to look at the walls of the house. We get a PET scan to see if there's mold in the walls, and we get the neuropsych testing to check out the plumbing and electric and internet and utilities. And we get the results of the test, and the results show that I have mild cognitive impairment, likely caused by Alzheimer's disease. I'm already starting to get accumulation of these abnormal proteins in my brain. So I come out of the office with this diagnosis, and maybe I do share it with my close friends and family. What about my job? Is this something that I have to share with my employer, or should share with them, or should prepare how to monitor my fitness for the job? Is it something that should be assessed yearly? Because I think some of the stigma might be related to things like productivity and our work.
Absolutely. Or even if you're not working, when do you know when you can stop driving?
Exactly.
I mean, this is incredibly important. This is why we have to separate the stage from the cause. Just because you have that abnormal amyloid in your brain and you are on this Alzheimer's continuum doesn't mean that you're going to have symptoms of it or that those symptoms are impairing your function. So that's why you have to get that stage, be staged appropriately, and you have to get that diagnosis, because in that early stage mild cognitive impairment, we can also diagnose you with not having the disease. And so this lady unfortunately got the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. She has that pathology in the brain. So what I would tell her is, right now things look okay, but your risk of having progressive cognitive declines slowly over time is very high. And this is where that utility test, the cognitive testing, is very important, because the cognitive testing helps us understand the impact on their ability to do things like driving and working, etc. So that's why we have to do this complete evaluation, right? That's why an amyloid scan in itself is not actually that helpful, because it just tells you what's going on as far as the pathology, the mold in the walls, but it doesn't tell you the impact on their life. And so there are patients that have amyloid in their brain that are working at high-level executive jobs and can continue to do the work that they are doing. But once you get that diagnosis, you have to start thinking about what would be the next steps. Or if a patient isn't working, what would it mean to be able to not drive? It always goes better when you have a plan for getting used to the idea of not driving than you walking in one day and I say, look, you're dangerous to drive. You haven't gotten used to it. You haven't come up with an alternative plan. So this further emphasizes the need to get an earlier diagnosis so that you can come up with a plan. You can come up with an advanced care plan around who would help you make decisions for you 10 to 15 years down the road when you need it, both around finances and around your own healthcare decisions. The diagnosis enables better planning. But that diagnosis in itself, having that amyloid in the brain, does not mean you can't do things, but it does mean that you're at risk of having progressive declines over time that could eventually impact your ability to do your job. Last thing I'll say there on the job is that it also depends on the job that you're doing. if your job could potentially put yourself or others at risk, then we might have to tell you to stop doing that sooner than other jobs. The goal here is always to improve quality of life while balancing both the autonomy and independence of that patient with the safety of the patient and their community.
You mentioned that sometimes Alzheimer's can onset at an early age, earlier than age 65, and that some of those cases are associated with genetic predispositions, things that are inherited throughout families. We've been hearing a lot in the news lately about genetic testing related to cancer. So for example, the BRCA gene and women who go in and get mastectomies preventatively because it runs in their family, breast cancer, things like that. How do you think about inherited forms of Alzheimer's? Do we need to be asking our doctors to perform an assessment of our genetic history, to be doing this genetic testing in advance? And how do you have those conversations?
There are genes that are deterministic, meaning that if you have that gene, you'll get the disease. And then there's risk factor genes, meaning that you have a gene that if you have it, it increases your risk of developing the disease. I'll start with what I call the deterministic genes, the ones that if you have it, you'll get the disease. These are very rare. At this time, there's not really any proactive screening for these, and I wouldn't advocate it for it at this time because there's not much that we would do differently in those patients. Once a patient's symptomatic, I do offer genetic testing for patients that have symptoms that are below the age of 65. We will do that genetic testing if they want to. Typically, it doesn't actually impact their care, but it has profound impacts on the family. Because if a patient has one of those deterministic genes, then each of their children have a 50% risk of developing the disease at some point in their life. I can't tell you when, but I can tell you they will develop it. And that can be very challenging for families. I often tell people you can not know information, but you can't unknow information. And so you really have to know what you're going to use it for, who wants to know, who doesn't want to know, and what their plans are as far as their own willingness to undergo testing. As I said, there's not much actionable that a patient can do right now to significantly reduce their risk of developing Alzheimer's disease besides the typical lifestyle factors that everybody should do. However, the risk factor genes, so that second bucket of genetics around Alzheimer's disease is this risk factor gene. ApoE is the most common risk factor gene that's in about 15% of the population. If people do commercial testing for genetics, this is often something that is shared with people. Also not too actionable. It's not something that I routinely recommend in my patients and not something I routinely recommend to family members at this time, if they're really worried about the development of the disease, again, because you're going to do very similar lifestyle modification with or without that gene. We have been testing for it more frequently because of some treatments around Alzheimer's disease and helping understand the risk of those treatments. But for now, I generally avoid recommending genetic screening en masse for people because there's not a lot to do and it can cause a lot of anxiety.
Let's talk about medical treatment for Alzheimer's disease. What is on the menu? Do we have pills? Do we have infusions? And how do you think about these medical treatments? Which ones are there just to help you cope with symptoms? Which ones are there to actually modify the course of the disease? And which ones are there to reverse or cure the disease? I think that one may not exist yet, but break down for us the medical treatments for Alzheimer's.
When we talk about medicine treatments for Alzheimer's disease, there's three general buckets. The first bucket are what we call symptomatic therapies, which modestly boost cognition, modestly optimize brain function. These are typically pills that are for all stages of the disease. Then in 2023, we developed a new bucket called the disease-modifying therapies, which slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease, keeping people at an earlier stage longer. These change the rate of progression over time. Those are typically for early stage Alzheimer's disease defined by the mild cognitive impairment to mild dementia stage. And they're more complex in that they're often given via infusion, injection. And then the last bucket are the medicines that are geared towards some of the behavioral manifestations of Alzheimer's disease if those symptoms arise in a specific patient.
The newer medicines that you just mentioned, the infusions, which can actually modify the disease course, in other words, slow the progression of the disease, keep you at an earlier stage longer. You said that those medicines are for people in the early stages, so the mild cognitive impairment stage, early stage. So that really drives home another point, which is to be evaluated early. Because if you wait too long and you land in the moderate stage, you no longer qualify for these medications that could potentially have slowed your disease. Is that correct?
That's right. It's a bit of a double-edged sword. We've been waiting in Alzheimer's disease to have a medicine that can slow the progression down. But if a patient presents too late, then they're not eligible. And the worst thing I can do is offer somebody a therapy that only exposes them to risk without any known benefit. So absolutely, these new therapies emphasize the importance in early diagnosis, getting people at that mild cognitive impairment to the earliest stages of mild dementia. But I think it's also really important to note that these medicines are complex and they have side effects. And I tell this to all of my patients, like, my goal is never to get a patient onto treatment. My goal is to open the door. Open the door so that they understand what's going on. They understand their options, whether they would be eligible, what are the risks, what are the potential benefits. And then they have to make the decision that makes best sense for their own value system, their own age, what they want to do. And that's fine. But the worst thing we can do is not get the patient in there in time and then the decision is made for them. And so an early diagnosis results in more options for patients, whether they go on treatment or not. I completely agree with you. This really does emphasize the need for early detection of cognitive impairment.
Well, I've learned a lot from this conversation. I just want to say thank you so much to you, Armin, for coming to speak with us at REMO about Alzheimer's. And just thanks for bringing your expertise. It's really wonderful to hear about the tried and true treatments and some of the newer ones that are coming down the pike. So thanks again.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Talking Dementia with REMO Health. If you're looking for more information, resources, and expert insights, visit remo.health and subscribe so you never miss an episode. Until next time, take care.